On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Paul Wolfowitz was the intellectual star of the neoconservative crew that pushed the country to war with Iraq. Today, he's the World Bank president who used his position to land his girlfriend a sweetheart job and cast a global pall over his own anti-corruption drive at the bank. Now, judgment day, with long knives out for his scalp. The White House stood by him until it didn't, saying for the first time Tuesday that all options were on the table. Paul Wolfowitz stands for much of what America's face to the world has been in this young century. And today, that face is in deep trouble. Up next, On Point, Wolfowitz, Last Stand. Joining me first today from New York is Peter Goodman. He's international economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Peter Goodman, thanks for being with us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So where does it stand right now? We're talking this morning. There will be consultations going on all day. What do we know about where the executive directors stand and about Wolfowitz's fate at this minute?
Well, there's two key channels. The first and the most immediate is this 24-member executive board that oversees the bank that's got in hand a report produced by this ad hoc committee, a subgroup of the board, that issued a devastating report that finds that Wolfowitz breached his contract, he undermined the credibility of the bank, he violated ethics rules when he engineered this raise for his longtime companion, Shahar Rizo, when he first arrived at the bank to resolve an obvious conflict of interest. The board is going to take a look at this report. They're going to deliberate on a key question that's teed up in that report, namely, can he now continue to lead the bank? But at the same time, these 24 members take direction from governments around the world. They represent those governments. And there have been numerous back-channel conversations between board members and their governments, between those governments and the United States, to try to resolve this in some fashion without a decisive vote at the board, which would break with all World Bank tradition. I mean, it's a consensus-driven body.
So where does that stand? We read the German development minister saying he, Wolfowitz, would do the bank and himself a great service if he resigned. It would be the best thing for all concerned. That's not gilding the lily at all. It's straight out there. Resign, sir.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, there's just an international groundswell. He's lost the staff inside the bank. He's lost certainly a majority of the board. Most of the board, depending on the accounts you believe, he has the U.S. in his corner to a degree. The U.S. is joined by Japan. But as you noted at the beginning, I mean, yesterday we heard from the White House that all options are on the table. And the new strategy from the White House seems to be a recognition that he really can't continue to lead the bank. As you say, the German development minister today said, look, you know, don't come to Berlin next week for our Africa forum. It would be distracting if you're still in your job and you really ought to resign. We've heard similar disinvitations from other parts of the world. Wolfowitz has apparently canceled a trip to Slovenia for later this week for another development event. So the White House now seems to be signaling that if the board will either exonerate him or slap him on the wrist in some fashion, censure him, reprimand him, but not fire him, then there can be a conversation about replacing him. And at this point, there's been real pushback on the board. There's a feeling that, you know, hey, come on, we've been told both by the White House and particularly by Wolfowitz's Washington lawyer, Bob Bennett, that we're running a kangaroo court, that this isn't a real deliberative process. And we've said, no, we're going to examine the facts and we're going to go through the process. And now we have this really damning document that reads like an indictment. And at the 11th hour, you're now saying, let's make a deal. Well, no, we're going to continue on with our process. And the best thing I'm hearing this morning from people who've been briefed by board members is for the White House to take care of this, for the White House to take Wolfowitz aside and say, it's simply time for you to go.
Does it look as though the White House could do that? President Bush has stood up repeatedly in recent days. Vice President Cheney speaking glowingly of Paul Wolfowitz. Are they in a position where they can do it? What's the pressure that they feel? This is a White House that's shown itself impervious to a certain amount, a pretty substantial amount of flack.
There's no question that we're dealing with a White House that's got, you know, 28% approval ratings. Some people say the only thing this administration can really deliver at this point is standing up for its friends. And Paul Wolfowitz is certainly one of its friends. He was a primary architect in the Iraq War. He's been a loyal soldier. That's the view from many inside the White House. Vice President Dick Cheney did say, as you note, in an interview this week that he found Wolfowitz to be a dedicated public servant, that he should stay. And there have been signals that the White House, until yesterday, was seeing this as a test of American resolve, that this struggle had become larger than simply an issue of who runs the World Bank, that it had become as one person I've been talking to at the White House put it, a test of the American imperative to both name the World Bank president under a longstanding agreement that goes back to really the beginning of the bank 60 years ago, and simply American influence in the world. There are people within the White House who see this entire issue as a European power play. Wolfowitz was very unpopular when he first came in as the president 2 years ago because of his role as an architect for the Iraq War. And there are people in the administration who think he's never had a fair shake. This isn't such a big deal. But what has clearly dawned on the White House in the last 24, 48 hours is that that view is just simply not shared elsewhere in the world. And this document, this report, lays out in really just a striking detail and in strikingly harsh language for the World Bank, which is a place where elliptical language tends to carry the day, that he broke the rules and he's hurt the institution, and it essentially calls on him to step aside.
And so Wolfowitz hangs by a thread. By the time some of our listeners hear us this evening, it's possible that he will be gone. Peter Goodman with The Washington Post in New York, please stand by. I want to welcome to our conversation from Princeton, New Jersey, Anne-Marie Slaughter, Dean of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. She's got a new book coming out, The Idea That Is America, out next week. Anne-Marie Slaughter, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly, is here. Jack, good to have you as well.
Hello, Tom, Peter, and Anne-Marie.
Anne-Marie Slaughter, how do you assess this moment, first for Paul Wolfowitz, and secondly, for American power and influence in the world? Is this a tipping point? You know, has the gang that came in enamored of unilateral American power brought America low?
Let me start with Paul Wolfowitz. It's a very sad time for him. I think in many ways he has been a distinguished public servant. He's served by his lights as best as possible, and he has a long record of actually commitment to development dating back to his time as ambassador in Indonesia. And to his credit, he sought a much more ambitious development plan for Iraq, and he was vetoed within the administration. But the larger issue, which the White House seems incapable of seeing, is that this is not about one man. This is about a style of leadership, not just Paul Wolfowitz's style of leadership, but American leadership, in which we seem to put our power and our prerogative and loyalty to individuals above the good of an institution that is supposed to serve the entire world.
So is it just a setback for that view, kind of the neocon view, if we could put it that way, or is it a setback more fundamentally for the United States? Will the U.S. come out of this, disempowered after this gang of power?
We come out weaker. Once again, it's not a tipping point. It's just the latest in a long series of events very like this, where just imagine what would have happened if right at the beginning, when there was apparent that there had at the very least been an ethical breach, the White House had said, look, we think that the World Bank has to stand for absolute integrity. We take the mission of the bank very seriously. We are going to make sure that Wolfowitz resigns and we replace him with someone who is completely unimpeachable, even if this is through no fault of his own. Our leadership would be strengthened. Our commitment to the values our allies share would be strengthened. And instead, it's now once again, we look like it's about American power, and everyone else can say what we want is an institution that serves the goals of developing countries.
Jack Beatty, Paul Wolfowitz has stood for American power for a long time, and it's aggressive, ambitious use.
He has indeed. You know, he's the epitome of the neoconservative writers and marginal academics whose brainchild this war is. And American Power was right at the center of it. He was one of the authors of a 1991 defense document that essentially was a blueprint for U.S. global hegemony that talked about, you know, essentially sitting on the world to prevent the rise of any other great power, that outlined unilateralism as the path for U.S. diplomacy, that spoke of preemption against threats, and that became really the nucleus of the Bush doctrine. And of course, we know that through the years of his, when he was in the government, and then when he was at Johns Hopkins as dean of the Advanced School of International School of Advanced International mm-hmm. Study, he pushed relentlessly the idea that Saddam Hussein had to go. That was his cause. And you'd think that a man who made that his mission would want to do it right. And yet, before the Congress, he said, when General Shinseki had said that several hundred thousand more troops were needed to secure Iraq after the war, Wolfowitz said it's, quote, hard to imagine that it would take more troops to provide stability in post-war Iraq than it did to defeat Saddam. Well, we now know.
Not hard to imagine anymore.
No.
Emory Slaughter. For a moment, let's look at it from the Wolfowitz perspective. I mean, he wanted to come in and fight corruption. I have no doubt he saw the World Bank as a great big bureaucracy, you know, that just wasn't gritty enough in doing that. Do you have sympathy for the guy? I mean, bureaucracies can pull out knives and take down people who want to make change.
I have sympathy in the sense that I think what he has wanted to do in terms of fighting corruption is very important. And of course, part of the scandal is precisely that he's made this his issue and he's being hoisted by his own petard. But I think he is responsible for his leadership style. And I think his leadership style is actually emblematic of what's wrong with the administration's leadership style as a whole, which is that they see it as a kind of badge of honor to be disliked, to break China, because that indicates that they're strong leaders and that compromise or consultation are actually signs of weakness. And that is, I think, a disastrous style of leadership. I mean, good leadership has consultation built in. It's part of good management. You don't make enemies unless you absolutely have to. You don't regard going slower or taking others' advice as weak, but rather as wisdom. And you don't see any of that in how he's managed in the World Bank. And frankly, that is, I think, the trademark of the worst parts of this administration's leadership.
Peter Goodman, but now he's saying, look, I'll talk about that. I'll change. Let's talk about my leadership style. I'll bring in people that I excluded from the chain of power here. Too late?
Well, yeah. That scene is simply too little, too late. He's been too isolated for too long. He surrounded himself by his own coterie of people he brought in, disregarding the advice of his vice presidents. It's worth remembering that Robert McNamara came in as World Bank president in the 1970s, fresh from making an enormous mess in Vietnam,
yep.
as many people saw it, mm-hmm. and is widely viewed as one of the best presidents, if not the best presidents, the World Bank has ever had. And he did that by winning the support of stakeholders, by truly running the World Bank as a multilateral institution. I mean, this is the account that you hear in the hallways of the bank today, whereas by contrast, Wolfowitz comes in. He faces enormous resistance. Again, he brings in his own people and isolates himself. But moreover, he then uses the institution as essentially an adjunct of the Bush administration, according to his critics.
In what respect? So how?
Well, he talks about boosting aid for sub-Saharan Africa, and a lot of speeches are made. He takes trips to Africa.
Yeah.
There's a fundraising campaign. But there's a parallel obsession that many people say has been very distracting with opening an office in Iraq, supporting the Iraq war through the World Bank, supporting the war in Afghanistan as well. And as a result of that, he lost not only the people he never had who were predisposed to oppose him, but even the people who said, well, let's give him a fair shake. It could be as a neocon. He's in a position to forge a consensus on aid. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the right views us as just, you know, we're flushing money down the drain.
George Will says the whole thing should go away, the World Bank.
Right. And here's a guy who as Anne-Marie Slaughter notes, you know, had been the ambassador in Indonesia, is a believer in aid, had a lot of support, for instance, in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. And there were those who hoped that he would be able to really be an effective World Bank president, but he pretty well alienated those people.
You mentioned Robert McNamara, and of course there's this eerie thing where McNamara had Vietnam and came to the World Bank, Wolfowitz had Iraq and came to the World Bank. I've got a little tape, though, of the very that conveys the very different spot in which Robert McNamara came down. He, of course, was one of JFK's best and brightest, architect of the Vietnam War, Secretary of Defense from 61 to 68. Rough time. In 68, President Johnson picked him, Robert McNamara, to lead the World Bank. He ran it to pretty broad acclaim until 1981, 13 years. Here he is giving a speech at the Smithsonian Institution in 1995. Listen to what he holds up as important.
I believe we should strive to create a world in which relations among nations would be based on the rule of law, a world in which national security would be supported by a system of collective security, a world in which the conflict prevention, conflict resolution, peacekeeping functions, which are necessary to accomplish the objectives I've outlined, would be performed by multilateral institutions.
And there it is, Anne-Marie Slaughter. It's almost like a litany of the words to give Paul Wolfowitz and neocons the heebie-jeebies: collective security, conflict prevention, resolution, multilateral institutions. Does this mean that there's a world out there that is reality-based, that a neoconservative kind of approach simply cannot change? Is this the defeat marker?
I think it's one more marker of the defeat. I was taking notes listening to McNamara and thinking, you know, yes, and no one ever doubted that McNamara was a strong leader or that the United States was not at the height of its power when he was both in government and at the World Bank. And yet it's a vision of our using our power to strengthen institutions and to lead through institutions rather than against them, whereas I think the Bush administration came in believing, again, that the mark of power was to be able to just do what you want and to kind of have an attitude that the dogs bark, but the caravan passes and we're at the head. And that is just not working and has not worked.
Jack, take us back to Paul Wolfowitz and where that came from. I mean, he's been an interventionist for a long time. I've seen that work to the good. I was in the Philippines when he pushed for Marcos to go, and that was a blessing for that country in those days, U.S. exerting its power in just that way. But it got a lot rougher later. Where's this impulse come from?
Well, it seems to come from Henry Jackson. I remember him as a young boy, young man.
Scoop,
yeah.
Yes.
He was on the McCarthy committee, and he was the only person there who looked halfway young. I remember he had a nice haircut, and I thought, Gina, this is a guy who, he's not one of these old fuddy-duddies. Well, Scoop was a cold warrior, and the Nixon-Kissinger detente, that policy, deeply offended him. And he has exerted a great deal of influence from the Senate to change U.S. foreign policy. He wrote legislation that had that effect in the Soviet Union in relation to its treatment of dissidents and its ban on Jewish immigration.
And the Soviet Union fell, and the people in the Wolfowitz camp saw this as an indication: stand up, be tough, and you can change the world.
Stand up, be tough, and you can change the world. And, of course, what was restraining them for the longest time was the Cold War, the nuclear balance. Once that was gone, I think these people suddenly believed, well, gosh, we have this tremendous power. We can do things with it. We can reshape the world. We can, committee for a new American century that Wolfowitz helped to start, that project for a new American century, that was the whole idea. We will reshape. The world is plastic. We can reshape it with U.S. power. That sounds grand, but you know what it comes down to? It comes down to kids from Kansas and New York and all over the going to terrible places and dying. And, you know, when you look at this group, not a one of them served in the military. Not a one of them, I doubt, has even been in a schoolyard fight. And yet these guys have been brave with other parents' children. And that's the instrument that we were going to reshape the world with. And we can never forget that the people who didn't serve have been hottest for other people's children to go and fight and die.
Let's hear from our listeners in Webster City, Iowa. Larry's calling. Larry, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It seems to me that the Wolfowitz situation is just a symptom of a bigger problem with the Bush administration, that they seem to think that they're above the rules, above the law. You see that with the Gonzalez situation. You see that with the FBI and the illegal wiretaps. You sometimes wonder if that might be part of the problem with the Halliburton no-bid contracts. And I guess I just see this as being another example of that hubris that makes them believe that they can do whatever they darn well please and nobody should ever say anything about it.
To Wolfowitz, you know? Should he stay or should he go, Larry?
I think he should go. I think he's pretty much proven that he's ineffective. And you can't be effective when everyone's pointing fingers and telling everybody else what a rotten SOB you are. You know what I mean?
We got it loud and clear. Larry, thanks for that. Let me take another call from Brookline, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm an occasional consultant to the World Bank, and
yes,
it's clear that Wolfowitz has to go, but at the same time, the World Bank itself is in many ways a very dysfunctional institution. Many of the people in it are so glad to have these high-paying tax-free jobs in America that they are far too deferential to their superiors. They're far too interested in producing numerically impressive results without thinking about what's going on the ground. And the sad thing about Wolfowitz is he's such an incompetent and ham-handed administrator that the notion that the bank needs reform is somehow getting lost in all of this, because he really had some agenda items that I thought were quite sensible.
But you didn't see him implementing those, Mark? Was he having an impact before the girlfriend crisis?
No, he wasn't, because of what everybody, including your guests, have said. Tom Ricks says he was a terrible administrator when he was at the Defense Department, and he's clearly a terrible administrator now. I mean, he's an academic. The people I know at the bank think, among other things, that he's a coward, that when there's a tough decision, he won't make it. He tries to get somebody else to make it for him. He's actually internally very conflict-averse, which is kind of ironic.
And the next thing you know, he's standing before his staff, and there the catcalls are flying. But Mark has worked in it, Peter Goodman, and says, look, there is a problem here. Wolfowitz may have been ham-handed, but the World Bank is dysfunctional, he says, and was before Wolfowitz arrived.
Well, just to add to Mark's point, let's remember that Paul Wolfowitz is someone who was passed up to head the Provisional Authority in Iraq because it was thought that he was not as good a manager as Paul Bremer.
Oh, okay.
But
low hurdle.
I think Mark makes a good point. There are a lot of people in the bank who are now rabidly anti-Wolfowitz, think he has to go, who do worry about governance. I mean, the smaller issue is that the ethics committee comes out not looking very good in this whole incident. As the bank report notes, their advice to Wolfowitz was, quote unquote, not a model of clarity, which is really an understatement. It was very confusing, and a lot of people appear to have dropped the ball at not following up to see what came of these salary negotiations. But a larger point is that, I mean, if you look at his anti-corruption initiative, there's a feeling even amongst some people who are pushing him out, who are now pushing Wolfowitz out the door, that when he goes, that's the end of momentum for anti-corruption work in particular, and that the French have been pushing this in part because they would have to pick up the tab for aid that would be lost to former French colonies in Africa if, for instance, aid's cut off because of the anti-corruption work. And the whole issue of governance now essentially gets shelved with the so-called old guard back in power having offed Wolfowitz.
Wow, what a picture. Anne-Marie, where does this leave us? It sounds like a kind of super mess where you now, our consultant Mark suggests, and Peter as well, perhaps it will be difficult to address problems that were legitimately there to be addressed. Back to a kind of status quo that wasn't working optimally. At the same time, U.S. influence, even if it changes hands, diminished.
Well, I think that's right. That's what I meant about this is putting personality and power prerogatives over the good of the institution, because we could have, by changing the leadership early on, said, look, we're very committed to Paul Wolfowitz's agenda. He's not the right person to implement it, but we're now appointing someone else who will carry this forward, because it is an important agenda, and the World Bank does indeed need major reforms. I think that the White House could still pull that out at the last minute. Part of what I think you're hearing from other countries is they don't want to be in a position of forcing us to do the right thing. They don't want another full-scale confrontation. They want us to do the right thing. And even now, if the White House would realize this is not about loyalty to one person and that one person should put the institution ahead of his own career, and that would say he's going to resign, here's our person to appoint him, we'd like to take this moment to affirm our commitment to his agenda, it would be ugly and we'd be further scarred, but it would we'd be able to salvage something.
Even now, it sounds like it could happen. We'll see. Let's take a call from Buffalo, New York. Gene, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, it seems to me that the number one, I think Wolfowitz should go.
Okay.
And it seems to me that the move against Wolfowitz is an oblique or indirect criticism of the United States' actual involvement in this Iraq war.
Not so oblique.
And a criticism of Wolfowitz as an architect of that criminal disaster. But that's the subtext. The surface text is the apparent ethics violation of him getting this job for his girlfriend, which itself, you know, in and of itself is bad. But the great German philosopher Hegel has a concept, the cunning of history, so that history, in a sense, works behind the backs of the actors. And in my view, that refers to the subtext of the removal of Wolfowitz and a shift toward Europe away from the United States.
A shift in what? A shift in global power, influence?
A shift in influence, and certainly perhaps even in economic power. I'm not discussing military power. I think we're actually at the stage where we are beyond the role of military power as a means of settling differences. Despite the fact that wars continue to go on,
right.
I think that is already an unreal notion, and again, in the sense of Hegel, as unreality, even though wars are being fought.
Gene, we've got it. Anne-Marie, I mean, you say this isn't the watershed, but is this then another marker? Are we seeing the shift in power? Is this, you know, the neocons ending up downshifting American power generally and to Europe? Is that where it now sits or elsewhere?
Well, I certainly think this is again one more proof that the approach that the administration came in with has failed and is failing. We are seeing both Secretary Rice and Secretary Gates pursue a quite different approach, and to the extent we've had any successes, say in North Korea and even more recently in trying to deal with Iran, it's been through a very different approach. And this is just one more piece of the coming apart of the machine that the administration came in with.
We're talking this hour about Paul Wolfowitz's last stand, perhaps, at the World Bank. Peter Goodman joins us from The Washington Post. Anne-Marie Slaughter is here. Her new book out just this week, The Idea That Is America, Keeping Faith with Our Values in a Dangerous World, sounds timely. Jack Beatty's here as well. Let's listen to some sound yesterday from Tony Snow briefing reporters at the White House, throwing out a big fat hint that maybe their support for Wolfowitz has its limits.
They say all options are on the table. This is not to leap to any conclusions, but to give you a statement of fact, which is members of the board, Mr. Wolfowitz, need to sit down and figure out what is, in fact, going to be best for this bank to be able to serve.
And outside the World Bank yesterday, these demonstrators. No deal for Wolfowitz, they say. Let's go to John in Westboro, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, I just have a simple question. Why doesn't the board just fire Wolfowitz? It's not as though there is anything that this administration can do at this time that's going to improve the reputation. It's not like the board is trying to save Wolfowitz. It's just they want him out and they want him to resign or they want the White House to take care of it. They should just fire him.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe for one thing, it's never been done in the 62-year history of the bank. But, Peter, give us a sense of the diplomacy and the interests behind this kind of, you know, you do it, no, you do it dynamic.
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. I mean, there's now a consensus on the board. There's a consensus pretty much everywhere outside of the United States and Japan, which seems to be standing with the United States, that he's got to go. And there's a feeling of it really would be great if someone else would push him off the ledge. This board, again, 24 people, they take direction from the governments they represent. And for those governments, this is one issue, who runs the World Bank, among many in a complex relationship with the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And how much political capital is, say, France willing to spend? Sarkozy comes in. He's the new president. Does he want to start things off with an open fight with the Bush administration? Gordon Brown taking over in the UK. Complicated situation for him in that Tony Blair was seen domestically as some people put it, the Bush administration's poodle. He certainly doesn't want to repeat that. On the other hand, how much political capital does he want to spend? And
so there's still fear of the Bush administration. Fear, respect, call it what you will. They don't want to offend it.
It's partially fear. It's partially that it is a multilateral world, and the United States, like it or not, is a very powerful player. And if you want to get something done on your own issue, you mm-hmm. need generally to have the cooperation of the United States. But also, there are enormous procedural questions that confront the board if it goes to a vote. It's really, as one person I talked to last week put it, yep. it's a jump ball. Nobody knows what will happen. The U.S. has 16% of the vote. Japan has, I believe, 8% of the vote. The Europeans as a bloc have 20 to 30% of the vote. What happens to the executive directors on the board who represent multiple countries? Take Spain, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They also represent Honduras, Guatemala, Costa Rica. If Dick Cheney calls up the president of Guatemala and says, we need you on this, mm-hmm. does that lock up the vote? Do you have an abstention? Does that help Wolfowitz? Does it hurt him? Do you need a majority of all votes cast, or do you need 51%? Nobody knows. They don't vote.
Let's go to Adam in Boston. Adam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
I want to make the point that I think this is part of the inevitable backlash, the external backlash, that is the outside of the country, and we're seeing a similar internal backlash against the Bush administration. And I think that what the world's waiting for is to see some leadership, probably from the Democrats. The Democrats are the presumptive holders of the executive branch unless they screw it up in 2008. But I think the world would be willing to bet on that. And I think that what should happen is the Democrats should step up and start essentially conducting a second foreign policy that will send the message that says, you know, the United States is getting ready to emerge from its period of insanity, and we'd like to do whatever we can to maintain, our standing and our ability to be a good international citizen.
Well, some hint of that in Congress right now, and more than a hint, but it's not easy to do from Capitol Hill. Let's go to Isabel in Uxbridge, Massachusetts. Isabel, you're on the air.
Hello. I have a statement. I have relatives in Europe, and the opinion of the American government has just decreased over the last 8 years, 7 years. When I talk with relatives in Ireland, it's almost embarrassing that we still have the government in that we have in, because the government seems not to listen to the people or to the people of other countries. That's my only statement. Thank you.
Well, Isabel, we've got it. And let me get one more from Hampton, Connecticut. Hampton, Connecticut, we've got Joe calling there, if I can get Joe up.
Oh.
Joe, you're on the air.
I just wanted to – my point is, I think when we look back on this point in history with Wolfowitz and his career with the bank, I don't think it's going to be looked at as having any significant effect on the United States power position in the World Bank itself. And that's really my only statement.
And what about more broadly? Do you see U.S. power in trouble here, diminishing, receding, Joe, or not?
I don't, for one reason. I think the world depends on us for too much, and I think that will help. You know, whether they like us or agree with us with all their points, I think they do depend on us for a lot, and I don't think we'll drop it.
Joe, we've got it. Our time is short. Anne-Marie Slaughter, how about that view? That's been a kind of default American position for a very long time. Does it still hold water?
Well, it may hold water in the sense that if things really do come to a showdown and we're willing to spend a lot of political capital, we can still get our way. But every time we do that, we weaken ourselves across the board in other ways. And the main thing is the governments we're dealing with are democracies, many of them, and they have to answer to their people. And when their people see this sort of thing going on, governments pay a price for standing with us. And so that's why, even with all our money and all our power, we are being weakened in the currency of influence that allows us to get our way in the world of diplomacy.
Jack Beatty, quite a moment for this country when the unipolar guys appear to be about ready to get ridden out of town on a rail. Still a lot of American power, but wow, what a dipsy doodle this time has been.
Yes, and you know, look at our military power. We have not been able to achieve our ends in Iraq through military power. Now, I don't think it's the fault of the military. I think it's intrinsically undoable an insurgent to stop an insurgency like that, especially after people like Wolfowitz starved our side of the forces needed to make it prevail. But that's been a weakening of American power. I mean, you know, people all over the world look at that and they say, well, this great giant can't even get the road to the airport from the airport to the green zone to be safe. And that's an incalculable loss right there. Just this feeling that, you know, even when we commit our forces, we can't, through force, get anything done. In fact, we seem to make it worse. So, yeah, I think these neocons coming in, as you say, hoping to assert U.S. power, really are going to be leaving, having weakened it everywhere.
And, Peter, what about the more narrow chips on the table? Do you see the United States coming out of this still with its lock on the World Bank presidency in effect? There's been pushback against that for a long time. Will that end up being part of the price for the Wolfowitz tumble?
I do see that arrangement lasting certainly for a few more years, in that the major European countries don't want to give up their rights to name the head of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, the bank's sister institution. And for that reason, it's hard to imagine that a deal will be cut where the U.S. gives up the right to name the president of the World Bank.
So likely to hang on to it. Anne-Marie, do you agree formally? Do we come out with the same sort of power that we went in with?
Formally, we do, although, again, I agree that we are weakened much more generally. But, yeah, I think for the next 5 years at least, this arrangement will probably stick. I think the larger damage is that we are now in a position where, ironically, the very values that Wolfowitz came in, you know, wanting America to promote, the values that Scoop Jackson wanted to stand for against Nixon, are now values that America is giving a bad name to in the world. And we have to find a much better way to work with other nations to promote those values.
Well, what a day, what a picture. Anne-Marie Slaughter at Princeton, author of the new book, The Idea That Is America. Anne-Marie Slaughter, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Peter Goodman in New York, international economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Peter, great to have you. Thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. Good to have you as always, Jack.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.